From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. 2 days after Egypt's military removed President Mohamed Morsi, the country's Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court takes office as interim president. Joshua Landis and I talk with Samer Shahata, an incoming faculty member at the University of Oklahoma and an expert on Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood.
It is confusing, and it's certainly not the best of all options, because there is, of course, the principle of not removing a democratically elected leader, and of course that's been violated quite significantly.
And later, Joshua and I talk with Dana Mohammadzadeh. She's a recent OU graduate who now works in the development sector in Kabul.
It is a city where every day 4 million people get up and go to work and go to school and have found ways to cope with an insecure security situation.
Everyday life in Afghanistan, but now the news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Well, historic events have continued in Egypt this week as violent protests have been ongoing, military ultimatums were given, and ultimately it appears that there was the removal of the president and an installation of a new interim president. So joining me in the studio to discuss this evolving situation in Egypt is, of course, our Middle East expert and regular panelist, Joshua Landis. And on the phone with us is incoming OU faculty member Samer Shahata, who is from Egypt and is an expert on the Muslim Brotherhood. So Joshua and Samer, welcome to the Worldviews Roundtable.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Samer, first I'm going to go to you. The situation in Egypt has, of course, been somewhat confusing in that President Morsi at least seemed to be standing firm and defying military orders to resign and then was apparently arrested and removed by force. And now I think it was a Supreme Court justice that was installed as president, is now the interim president. Can you help us understand a little bit what exactly has happened in Egypt this week?
Sure. Well, what's happened in Egypt this week is that for the last month and a half or so, a few groups, the rebel movement, the Tamarud movement, as well as the June 30th movement, have been planning massive protests to call for Mr. Morsi's resignation or removal or early presidential elections. And that was planned for June 30th. And there was a great deal of expectation about that date. No one knew how many people would actually turn up to protest Mr. Morsi. And of course, their criticisms are legion, having to do with incredibly poor leadership, to the idea that the Muslim Brotherhood was entrenching itself in state institutions, making their removal through elections in the future impossible, and other criticisms of Mr. Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, I think many of us saw on June 30th millions of people exceeding expectations on the streets against Mr. Morsi. And then shortly thereafter, the defense minister, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who incidentally was appointed by Mr. Morsi last year, made an announcement. And he essentially gave Mr. Morsi an ultimatum, 48 hours to address the people's grievances and to come to some kind of, you know, mediation with the opposition, or else the military would have to intervene.
But this was a democratically elected leader. I mean, the complaints must be really significant if they're willing to remove him, Joshua. And now what happens, you know, the United States is in a situation, I mean, in that they need to cut off aid. I mean, that's what the U.S. law, I suppose, requires in the issue of a military coup. But the United States seems to be kind of being a bit wishy-washy on this, suggesting that if there's a chance for more effective democracy, then we'll let this go forward. So what is the U.S. response likely to be in this case?
Well, the U.S. has been confused, I think, and much like the initial Egyptian revolution, where President Obama stuck with Mubarak until about the last week, once it was obvious that popular demand for his stepping down was irresistible. And then he went with the flow and joined the revolutionary forces, if you will. In this situation, he's done something similar, stuck with Morsi as the democratically elected president and constitutional, you know, against a coup d'etat, but then has moderated. And once they saw these incredible demonstrations and the likelihood of political violence, stepped back. And today it is confusing because Congress has passed a law that all U.S. aid, which is $1.3 billion, has to be stopped in case of a coup. So that means we have to stop aid. But a number of senators have stood forward and said, well, we have to play it by ear. And this is, you know, as if there can be a transition back to some kind of democratic representation and quick elections, then we can resume that aid and, you know, everything will go back to what it is. But the question I guess I have for Sammer here is, what's the likelihood that any kind of patch-up job and democratic procedures can be followed in the near future? I should think the Muslim Brotherhood is going to be furious. Now, I know they've said that they're not going to get sucked into violence, that they're going to step back and they're going to follow legal procedures. But the anger on the streets must be intense.
Well, yes. I mean, the anger among the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and among the supporters of Islamist groups in general in Egypt is one of outrage and indignation, because from their perspective, Egypt had a democratically elected president. No one called into question the integrity of those elections. And a year later, he is removed through essentially a military coup. Now, of course, the other side of that story is that this was not simply a military coup. It wasn't seven military officers removing a president or another military officer in the middle of the night. I mean, there were millions of people on the streets protesting in record numbers. So there was some popular support there. This is why it's murky. Just as the 2011 removal of Mr. Mubarak wasn't really a revolution in the sense that the entire political, economic structure and institutions of the society were not changed. I mean, the military, a pillar of the Mubarak regime, was still in power and is still in power today. Just as that was not a revolution and not only an uprising, what we saw over the last few days in Egypt isn't simply a coup in the traditional sense. People have called it a revolutionary coup, a coup supported by millions of people, a popularly supported coup. But the point is that it is confusing, and it's certainly not the best of all options, because there is, of course, the principle of not removing a democratically elected leader. And, of course, that's been violated quite significantly. And so it is going to be messy, as you indicate, from now on out.
So just very quickly then, are we likely to see any stability coming anytime soon in Egypt?
Well, I don't think that there's going to be chaos and civil strife. I think Egypt is not Algeria after the 1991 coup. But real democratic, inclusive political stability in which everyone believes in the basic institutions of the system and are allowed to participate, we're not going to see that, for the simple reason that the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists, I think, are going to be excluded institutionally or otherwise. And that's certainly not a recipe for democratic stability. And then again, we have the military in Egypt, an institution with an autocratic tradition, also being really the primary players.
Well, Sammer Shahat, Joshua Landis, thank you so much for helping bring some clarity to this very confusing and evolving situation this week. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. Write to us at worldviews@ou.edu or send us a tweet at worldviewsKGOU. Next, Joshua and I talk with Dana Mohammadzadeh. She graduated from the University of Oklahoma last year and now works in the development sector in Kabul. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. On Monday, Afghanistan's Interior Ministry announced that insurgents had killed nearly 300 local and national police last month, as well as 180 civilians. A day later, militants detonated a suicide car bomb at the gate of a NATO compound in Kabul, killing four guards and two civilians. Dana Mohammadzadeh says knowing attacks like these will happen is part of life in Afghanistan's capital city. She earned a degree in economics and international studies last year and now works in the development sector in Kabul. Dana Mohammadzadeh, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
So you're an OU graduate. You have an interest in international affairs. Your background is in economics and international studies. And you found yourself right after graduation working in a country that many of us might be surprised we'll send our students, Afghanistan. Tell us how you ended up in Afghanistan. Can you tell us anything about kind of what drew you to study or to work in a country like Afghanistan?
So as I was doing my job search second semester, senior year before graduating, I knew that I definitely wanted to go to the region. And so I'd been looking for different opportunities in various countries in the region. And I happened to come across one that was forwarded to me by some of my professors who heard about the job opportunity in Afghanistan. And so I followed through with that, got information about it, and decided that this was an opportunity that I wanted to be a part of, a country that I wanted to learn more about and specifically learn more about what the international community has been doing in Afghanistan and get involved in on the development end of things.
Now, you're an Iranian American.
Mm-hmm.
You speak Farsi, Persian. How much did getting your job at AID as a very young, fresh graduate have to do with your language skills?
I think speaking Farsi definitely contributed to the strength of my application. I think a lot of times in the development sector, candidates who can speak the language of the local community are preferred. And so I've been fortunate enough to use my Farsi skills there in speaking with colleagues and speaking with locals who I interact with.
Now, how much does it help you? I mean, what percentage of Afghans can understand Farsi? And what's the Dari is this sort of counterpart language. How many Afghans are Dari speakers or Farsi speakers, and how close is it to Dari?
I don't know the exact number, but almost every Afghan that I come across in Kabul can speak Farsi.
So as I mentioned, many of us think of Afghanistan as a high security risk. It's a country many of us would not consider traveling to, much less working in. What is it, upon your arrival there, what were some of the things that were really striking to you? I mean, you see images. It's a beautiful country, but, you know, it's obviously in its early development stages in terms of economic development and political development. What do you find striking about it in terms of the way the people live on a daily basis, going about their business as usual?
Yeah, definitely. So one thing I always say is Kabul is a city of more than 4 million people. And though the week before I left, there were two attacks within about 10 days of each other, it is a city where every day 4 million people get up and go to work and go to school and have found ways to cope with an insecure security situation. On that note, some of the things that I found surprising when I first got there was I thought I would be seeing more women in the streets. Sometimes I can... when we're driving around or getting around town, I can be driving for more than 5 minutes and see just a handful of women walking around. And I thought by this point there would be some more women getting around on their own or on foot.
So they still feel rather insecure as women in this country?
I don't know if it's so much to do with insecurity as it is maybe there's some restrictions on their personal travel imposed by themselves or family, or for whatever reason they don't have a need to go out. I'm not sure what it is, but there's just not as many women that I thought there would be walking around.
And so as a young woman yourself, does this concern you, or do you feel personally like there are security concerns with your own just living and existing in Afghanistan?
No, not so much for me. I think people are aware when there's a woman walking by or something, you know, they may look longer for whatever reason, but I don't personally feel in danger.
Now, do you get a lot of cat calls and that kind of thing, you know, sort of, hey, sweetie, that sort of thing as you walk around?
Not so much that, but there's definitely staring, and it happens to all the women, Afghan, foreign. I think it happens across the board.
We're speaking with Dana Mohammadzadeh, a 2012 graduate of the University of Oklahoma who now works in the development sector in Afghanistan. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Suzek Rilat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzek Rilat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Let's get back to our conversation with Dana Mohammadzadeh about everyday life in Afghanistan. Just before the break, she told us she was surprised at how few women she sees out in the streets of Kabul. Do you feel like the country is making any progress, that it's better off today than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 2 years ago? Is it moving in the right direction?
So in the 8 months I've been there, I've been able to see, for example, the changing of the seasons. And in that small time, one thing that I've been looking at as an indicator is roads, for example. It doesn't seem like there are any more. The road infrastructure is not getting better. There are still a lot of roads in Kabul right when the winter hit. I mean, it was just massive puddles and massive icy slush that was all over the streets. And the whole plan the whole time was, okay, they've been rebuilding these roads for the last couple of years now, and they will surely get these roads done by the time the winter hits. And still a lot of the roads were not done. So in terms of infrastructure, you also see a lot of buildings being built, but then now, like, one by my office is being rebuilt. It's a pretty big, maybe 15-story building, and it's been recently repainted, but I'm not sure who's going to be occupying those buildings. So it's difficult for me to say because I haven't seen the visual or the progress over the last decade. But when I talk to a lot of youth that are not necessarily youth, but in their late 20s, and ask them about the future direction of their country, I've talked to more than a few who have plans to go abroad. And
is that probably a consistent problem, I would imagine?
Yeah, I've heard it from
people leaving the country for a better life someplace else.
Yeah, I've heard it from more than a handful of people.
Let me ask you, as America prepares to leave, and we say we're going to leave militarily, or at least largely militarily, by 2014, mm-hmm. we're going to hear a big sucking sound of American money leaving Afghanistan. The GDP of Afghanistan is about $30 billion a year. That's $1,000 per person. Now, the endowment of Harvard or Princeton University is bigger than the GDP of all of Afghanistan. Their government revenues are about $2 billion a year. America, at the height of its occupation, was spending $6, $7 billion a month in Afghanistan. We've built up a big police force, a big military, all this infrastructure that is supposed to keep the Karzai government in place and keep Afghanistan from falling back into violence. How is Afghanistan going to maintain security if they're to go back to a budget of $2 billion and not have this giant funnel of money coming in from the United States? Or will America just keep on funding this for many years to come?
Yeah, I think if you look at the situation right now, Afghanistan requires a lot of international assistance to keep, I think, a lot of these structures from completely collapsing when international forces leave militarily. I think in a recent Tokyo conference, international aid and assistance was guaranteed for another couple years. But in that time, in that interim, Afghanistan will have to find ways to make up for the loss of international money being poured in order to keep their own government structures afloat.
What percentage of your friends in Afghanistan, the people you know, the professionals that you work with, are dependent on external money? I mean, how many of their jobs are going to be gone once all these aid dollars stop flowing into Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, I can say right now on my project, it is being completely funded by foreign governments. And so in that sense, once the project ends and once that money is no longer there, my colleagues will have to look for jobs elsewhere.
And how many of those are there?
Just on my project in particular, that's around 80 to 100 people.
But that must be replicated right across Kabul.
I imagine so, especially among those who have received university education from neighboring countries and have now secured jobs with international organizations. There will be more competition for those Afghans in terms of finding jobs with international organizations who are going to stay in the country.
So they're desperate to get out of the country and leave before this money stops?
Some people that I've talked to are looking at that as an option.
Can you see much evidence in Kabul of the drawdown in military forces there?
In my 8 months that I've been there, I haven't personally seen any international security forces. Everyone I've seen who is wearing a uniform is Afghan, is part of Afghan national security.
So the training of the Afghan security forces has pretty much worked in that respect, in that they've taken over at least the security responsibility for Kabul.
Yeah, looking at the day-to-day operations, it seems to be being run by Afghans. When there's unforeseen events that occur around the city, like suicide bombings. I don't know if foreign forces are stepping into that or not. But in terms of the day-to-day operations, it seems like it's being run by Afghans.
Have you been able to travel around Afghanistan at all?
I haven't been able to travel yet, but I have plans. I'm hoping to make my way up to some of the northern provinces.
Now, you must then spend a lot of time with expats in this town. So there must be this sort of very hothouse community of expats who spend all their time together. Do you go to restaurants most of the time? Do you go to hotels? Can you go hiking in the countryside, swimming? I mean, what's fun?
What's fun? Yeah, so a lot of expats will hang out at local restaurants around town. There's also in the summer and springtime, people will go to areas outside of the main city and hike in the mountains there. Over this past winter, I had the opportunity to go to various concerts at the Afghan National Institute of Music, which is a wonderful organization there that works with local children on developing their music skills. And so those were a wonderful event to go to. And then there's also various film showings around town. There might be a book club or two going on.
So there's cultural life.
There's cultural life, but a lot of people at the same time are there to work. And so they have very long and sometimes stressful work weeks. And
this is what I was thinking when Joshua asked the question about the kind of the community of expats. I mean, I could also see this kind of being a hotbed of people that really want to come together and work hard and long to help put Afghanistan back on the right path in terms of development and you know, do something really good for this country. Is that kind of the sense that you have and that community is there, kind of all unified to, you know, help save and preserve Afghanistan?
I think you see both ends of that. You see some people who have just their contract has sent them to Afghanistan and they're there to do their job and maybe didn't have much of an interest in the country beforehand. But on the same note, you do see a lot of people who have studied Afghanistan for years, maybe did their graduate school work on Afghanistan and have even taken language courses and really love the country and are there and interested and very invested in its future.
It's probably just like any place else. It's going to attract people mm-hmm. for the job or really because they want to contribute to an amazing outcome or something of that sort.
Exactly. I think you see both.
Well, you certainly are experiencing very interesting things, Dana. Thank you so much for being with us today on Worldviews to discuss your time in Afghanistan.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to our conversation with Dana Mohammadzadeh, a 2012 graduate of the University of Oklahoma who now works in Afghanistan's development sector. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, Holly Arias writes and produces our web content, and the show is edited by Brian Hardzinski. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolott.